So it's now my great pleasure to introduce you to John Bercow. John has been a positive voice at the heart of UK politics in speaking out against discrimination and the persecution of LGBT people around the world. John is a well-known supporter of LGBT rights and has included rainbow colours, pink triangles and the motto "All are equal" in his official coat of arms as Speaker of the House of Commons. Mr. Bercow is also the Honorary President of the Kaleidoscope Trust, which works to help LGBT people and rights movements around the world. It does this by encouraging the UK government, the Commonwealth, the EU and others to fight anti-gay prejudice and discrimination, especially that experienced by those who live in the 78 countries where homosexual activity is illegal, or where it is impossible for LGBT people to live openly and safely. And now I invite John to the podium to deliver tonight's lecture entitled Human Rights and Human Wrongs.
Gronnie, William, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for the warmth and generosity of the welcome that you've just extended to me. And I'm bound to say that having heard myself introduced, I can hardly wait to hear myself speak. Whether you'll feel the same way at the conclusion of my remarks is, of course, a matter for legitimate speculation and conjecture. But genuinely, it is a delight to be here, to be back in Belfast again and given another opportunity to impose my thoughts upon what I anticipate to be a tolerant audience. I say back in Belfast because in my time as Speaker, colleagues, I have spoken to a Youth Parliament event in this city and also to the annual conference of the Political Studies Association less, I think, than a year ago. I can already sense that those assembled today to hear my words and offer what I fully expect to be challenging questions will be at least as dynamic as the Youth Parliament attendees and no less distinguished than the academics whom I previously encountered. I'm also aware, however, that visiting politicians are scarcely a novelty in Northern Ireland this year, and compared with the G8 leadership, I must seem, frankly, a fairly modest offering. I shall do my best to make up for the fact that I am neither a head of state nor a head of government, but rather a humble speaker, or at any rate, a speaker who ought to be humble. I'm thrilled to bits to be amongst your number, and in particular to be in the company of my parliamentary colleague, and I hope my friend, Naomi Long. As you know, and this will be touched on in the course of my remarks, I am obliged to maintain political impartiality in conformity with the traditions of the British speakership, as between one party and another, and indeed, for that matter, as between members of political parties and the very small number of people who from time to time sit as independents. But I'm not obliged to be impartial about people who serve Parliament. Naomi, as I think you will readily attest, is courageous, principled, and dedicated, a superb parliamentarian, and I'm thrilled to know her as a colleague and that she has taken the trouble to be with us this evening. It's also been fun and a privilege for me, just before we started tonight, to meet the Mayor of North Down, recently elected, to his enormous credit, Andrew Muir. Andrew, I wish you good fortune in everything that you do, and I hope that you will feel, insofar as you need it and can be reinforced by it, a sense of warmth, of camaraderie, and of encouragement from people who are present here tonight. William, colleagues, before I get properly underway, I should like really to pay tribute to my hosts this evening, Amnesty International. Founded, of course, 52 years ago by Peter Benenson, it is frankly hard to identify a voluntary movement which has had a more profound impact on the lives of people across the world. Amnesty's purpose is simple, yet extremely ambitious, to protect people wherever justice, fairness, freedom, and truth are denied. Here in Northern Ireland, Amnesty's campaigning on human trafficking, and indeed on institutional child abuse, is living up to this vision and making us all ask ourselves questions which, although difficult and sensitive, need to be asked. I wish you, Amnesty here in Northern Ireland, every success with this vital work. It is, of course, no coincidence that I am here during Pride Week, and very proud to be. What was once a celebration marked by a tiny hard core of principled and brave individuals has been transformed into something approaching institutional status. This is a wonderful development in so many ways, but I hope and anticipate, colleagues, that institutionalism will not be the cause of inertia. This is hardly a crusade which is so well established that it can be contemplating what to do with its victory lap of honour. In pursuit of fairness for LGBT people and of human rights more widely, we are some way out of the starting blocks, but still well short of the finishing line. With that in mind, after some observations on the Northern Ireland context, I want to organise my remarks around three distinct themes and assertions. The first is to explain why I'm here, why I want to associate myself publicly with causes such as Pride Week, and why, despite the fact that association with them is a departure from the traditional role of the Speaker of the House of Commons, I believe with conviction that Speaker support for human rights is not just legitimate, but essential. The second is to offer you an overview of the work which the House of Commons undertakes across the whole realm of human rights, not only the most obvious issues relating to race, gender, sexuality, physical disability, and finally, emerging from the shadows, mental illness, but a wide range of matters which we may not think of in the category of human rights, but which, to my mind, really are. This section will focus on the work of the Joint Committee on Human Rights in Parliament, a body which was created some 13 years ago, and one of which I suspect the overwhelming majority of even this clearly upmarket audience might have only a modest, if any, prior knowledge. Because that is so, I want to set out what the Joint Committee on Human Rights has achieved in a little detail in the ambition that this will assist somewhat in acquiring for it a profile to match its importance. I freely admit that this section might seem more Geek Week than Pride Week, but I am wagering that you will put up with me on this matter. Finally and briefly, I want to set out a few reasons why I am an optimist about human rights in the United Kingdom, and I have every confidence that the Pride Week of 2023 will be an even larger event than we are witnessing this July, with a rate of expansion to match that seen in the last decade. Before I begin my lecture in earnest, however, it would be odd to stand here before you and not to reflect on some of the challenges to which eloquent and poignant reference has just been made by Grunier, some of the challenges facing the LGBT community in Northern Ireland. I am no expert on Northern Ireland, but in preparing for this lecture, I have spoken to people who indisputably are. I wish to share with you some sobering figures. There could be nothing more harrowing than what we have just heard from Grunier. But these figures are surely not insignificant, and there is a piquancy and a sobering quality, as I say, about them. 63% of young people experience harassment at school in Northern Ireland due to their sexual orientation. 57% of LGBT workers conceal their sexual orientation to some extent at work, and tragically, 29% of LGBT youth have attempted suicide. LGBT people can find themselves isolated when they come out, not just in a geographical sense in rural areas, though that certainly, but in being isolated from their own friends and communities. Those who know the situation here say that understanding, acceptance, or even tolerance of LGBT people in Northern Ireland lags behind that of other parts of the United Kingdom. I am not qualified, and it is not my place tonight to attempt a diagnosis of why this is so. That is surely a matter for you here, first to assess and then to address as you think fit. What I am qualified to say, however, as a human being and as a straight ally, is that prejudice, intolerance, and isolation on the basis of sexuality are a denial of humanity. Such treatment is sentencing people to a life of fear, self-doubt, and self-loathing. It is the theft of one of our most fundamental instincts, to love and to be loved. This issue is so much more than politics, religion, or diplomacy. It is about the subjugation of a fellow human being's freedom. It is painful, it is demeaning, it is dehumanizing, it is wrong. There are, however, some positive signs. The election of Andrew Muir as Mayor of North Down is a welcome example of where success in public life has not been denied by sexuality, but achieved on merit. The Northern Ireland Executive has recently introduced a workplace awareness raising project on LGBT issues, and the Justice Department's LGBT network has prepared awareness guidance for staff supported by the Minister. Northern Ireland also has a vibrant LGBT third sector community, exemplified by the Rainbow Project and other voluntary organisations. The LGBT community in Northern Ireland also has a proud history of working hard on equality and human rights across all issues, transcending historic divisions. These positive signs are welcome, and I wish to place on the record my personal support and encouragement for further progress in the future. So let me start with, why am I here? I recognise that the role of the Speaker of the House of Commons has not been associated with the sort of speech which I am about to deliver now, or indeed, frankly, with any of the other orations which I have offered since my election 4 years ago. This might lead some to contend that I have to demonstrate my right to do or to be something different, a notion that will frankly be all too familiar to some of you, if for other reasons. I am not apologetic in any way about my willingness to be on a platform such as this, or the fact that I am president of a charity, as has been said, the Kaleidoscope Trust, which works with LGBT people put at physical danger, and it's worth the repetition and the reiteration, because it is such a shocking thought, put at physical danger in at least 78 countries around the world, and even sometimes in Britain today, because of the nature of their love. I am thrilled to perform this role. My right to be different, as it were, stems from three factors which I believe are relevant. The first is that while I have the honour of being the 157th Speaker of the House of Commons, I was the first to be elected after a contest which involved open electioneering, written manifestos, hustling speeches to various groups of MPs, media interviews, and policy commitments. When I stood for this venerable office, I made it plain that I thought it needed to become more than a revered aspect of the world of Westminster, and had instead really to become a truly public office, reaching out beyond the chamber of the House of Commons, and not entailing the office holder being a prisoner of Parliament. No one who heard me make my case would have expected me, if elected, to be a shrinking violet. In that respect, I hope I have not disappointed them. Moreover, such an observer would have known that I would not be content to see the decline of the legislature as a check and balance on the executive of any party composition, continue unabated. I made the concept of an open speakership central to my campaign. I was fortunate enough to win, and I sense I have a mandate. The second is that the speaker should be clear about what the obligation to be impartial does mean and does not mean. Of course, colleagues, the speaker should be impartial between the parties and about the policy controversies raging between them. However, I do not believe that a speaker should be neutral about the importance of politics in our lives, agnostic about the merits of Parliament as an institution, disinterested in the values that underpin our democracy, or oblivious to the need to deepen democracy by ensuring equality of participation in it. Equality of participation rests on rather more than equality of franchise. Gay people, for example, were never barred from the franchise because of their sexuality. This does not mean that they have always been politically equal citizens. That is obviously not the case, and it's not even cast iron fact today. Democracy has to be about something more than a legal framework. It requires a stronger social underpinning, a cultural commitment to operate. I think that message is valid beyond the borders of Britain. I was an active member of the House of Commons Select Committee on International Development before becoming Speaker, and I took a particular interest in Burma, which, as some of you will know, I have continued to espouse. I hope to travel to that country later this month, a trip that will certainly be a first for the Speaker of the House of Commons. I have not been shy about condemning human rights abuses against LGBT people and other persecuted groups in other countries, including some nations which consider themselves to be democracies despite such prejudice, and I do not regard this as stepping outside the demarcation lines of my office. I think that silence would be a dereliction of duty. Finally, it seems to me to be incredibly important in this regard that Parliament makes the case for what it is doing to the public, and that responsibility rests with me too. In the modern world, it would be the height of arrogance for MPs to demand that electors read every word of Hansard, watch every moment of the Parliament Channel, and catch up on every activity of the committees of the House of Commons and the House of Lords, such as the Joint Committee on Human Rights. Frankly, this would be less public education than public punishment. And I speak as one of those who still loves reading Hansard, periodically watching the Parliament Channel when I am not in the chair, and taking an interest in the work of lesser-known committees. We have to take our story to the country. We have to prove our worth. We have to show that far more occurs of much greater significance than the legalised blood sport that is Prime Minister's questions, or the empty benches sometimes seen on television for late-night debates, might indicate. In doing this, we not only have to fight for national attention, but to fend off what is often corrosive media cynicism. It is a cause, nonetheless, in which I believe passionately, just as Pride Week warms my heart as well. I hope to demonstrate by the end of this speech that human rights are absolutely embedded in the work of the House of Commons, and that while we doubtless could or should do more, our primary problem is that this has been a sort of institutional iceberg with at most just over a tenth of what is there visible to those who we should most want to see it. All of which leads me logically to the Joint Committee on Human Rights, the invisible inspectorate. The JCHR is a relatively rare creature in several respects. As the name suggests, it is a combined committee of the House of Commons and the House of Lords, with six members drawn from each chamber. Besides being cross-institutional, it is also cross-partisan, with five Conservatives, four Labour Party members, two Liberal Democrats, and one independent amongst its membership. So neither House and no political party commands a majority. It is chaired by an opposition Member of Parliament, currently Dr. Hewel Francis, the Labour MP for Aberavon. I think that these qualities have been crucial to its success. The Joint Committee has a number of functions, but I would like to focus on three vital roles. The first is that of scrutinising laws. Since the Human Rights Act of 1999 came into effect some 12 years ago, ministers have to declare that any legislation they bring to Parliament is compatible with its provisions. The committee has therefore examined every single government bill since 2001 and sought to reach behind the assurance offered in ministerial statements of compliance by asking carefully targeted questions of the relevant minister to ensure that the measure truly is compatible with the Human Rights Act. The committee has evolved to become a highly effective gatekeeper in this respect and now regularly recommends amendments to bills which are not always those which ministers would deem helpful. It has become an increasingly confident and assertive voice within Parliament. To offer some practical implications of this evolving strength, I will very briefly set out the agenda of the committee since the last general election. In 2010-12, a two-year session, the committee reported in depth on the Armed Forces Bill, the Education Bill, the Identity Documents Bill, the Legal Aid Sentencing and Punishment of Offenders Bill, the Police Reform and Social Responsibility Bill, the Protection of Freedoms Bill, the Public Bodies Bill, the Terrorist Asset Freezing Bill, the Terrorism Prevention and Investigation Measures Bill, and the Welfare Reform Bill. It had a similarly enormous intray in the second session of this Parliament, which ran from 2012 to 2013. Since the last Queen's speech in May, it has concentrated on the Marriage Same-Sex Couples Bill and the Children and Families Bill. It will move on to the Antisocial Behaviour Bill, the Care Bill, the Immigration Bill, and the Offender Rehabilitation Bill. This is, colleagues, a vast docket, but the legislation concerned affects the lives of millions of our fellow citizens. The second aspect is undertaking thematic inquiries, deep and long-term studies into areas of government policy. These often cut across Whitehall departments or involve our national obligations and duties under the European Convention on Human Rights or other international human rights treaties. So in 2010-12, the committee carried out an inquiry into the human rights implications of UK extradition policy. Following this, the committee initiated an inquiry into the implementation of the rights of disabled people to independent living, which examined carefully the UK government's compliance with Article 19 of the UN Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities. When that was completed, the committee reported on the human rights of unaccompanied migrant children and young people in the UK in connection with the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child. This was published to considerable critical acclaim last month. As a deliberate consequence, the committee has served as a catalyst, prompting debate within Parliament on significant human rights themes, which would not have acquired the potency of publicity if it had not led opinion. Thirdly, the committee carries out shorter topical inquiries and one-off evidence sessions. This has again covered large and, to be candid, diverse territory. For instance, following the student disturbances in and around Westminster in the autumn and winter of 2010, the committee took oral evidence on the subject of how best to facilitate peaceful protests from student leaders and took such evidence from the police. It consulted with the TUC in advance of that organisation's national demonstration in March 2011. It took oral evidence on the government's counter-terrorism review at about the same time. It has acquired evidence at the end of every calendar year from the Secretary of State for Justice on the government's entire human rights philosophy. It has also, where possible, taken evidence from the Human Rights Minister on outstanding human rights judgments, and it follows up work on such decisions.
It has also taken evidence from the major human rights institutions of England and Wales, Scotland and Northern Ireland on human rights in the United Kingdom. It also carried out three notable evidence sessions over the space of 12 months, examining the tension in responsibility for human rights between the Supreme Court and the UK courts, the European Court of Human Rights, the UK Parliament and the UK government. On the second occasion, evidence was heard from the President of the Supreme Court and the Lord Chief Justice of England and Wales. On the third occasion, evidence was heard from the President of the European Court of Human Rights. The committee also carried out a pre-appointment hearing last October for the new chair of the Equality and Human Rights Commission, Baroness O'Neill of Bengrave. This is plainly a workaholic workload. Why does any of this matter? It does not, after all, as I have admitted, secure many headlines. Colleagues, it matters because the UK Parliament used to have, to be candid, quite limited credibility as an institutional actor on human rights. In fairness to Westminster, this was a deficiency identified in legislatures all over the democratic world. It led some to conclude that parliaments were basically incapable of concentrating on human rights, and might even be a menace to them. This argument was most forcefully expressed in the United States by Ronald Dworkin in his epic volume Law's Empire, in which he noted that parliaments were inherently majoritarian institutions, so could hardly be trusted to protect human rights, which usually involved numerically small or unpopular minorities in any society. The courts, he insisted, should feel free to step in to usurp congressmen or members of parliament. There is still obviously a lively debate about this issue. The argument ongoing today is, I think, state confidently, much more evenly balanced than it had become in the 1980s and 1990s. Back then, politics was heading towards an extremely awkward outcome, in which it was being suggested very seriously that democratic rights in Britain could be maintained only by the least democratic of our political institutions. This is surely a situation in which any society would be most uncomfortable to find itself. The fact that we have a more balanced argument is squarely due to the Joint Committee on Human Rights, even if this is not recognised throughout the land. The committee has pressed the government to keep Parliament fully and regularly informed about what it is doing to change law, policy, or practice in the light of a judgment, posing intrusive questions of the relevant ministers, both orally and in writing, asking for outside expert advice in its scrutiny of what ministers are doing in the realm of human rights, and reporting regularly to Parliament about the speed and the adequacy of that response, and on the shortcomings in the system of responding. It has become the institutional equivalent of a smoke alarm warning of the risk of human rights abuse, and a fire alarm when matters are really serious. In short, I can stand here and say, hand on heart, that I believe Parliament has never been more effective in human rights, and that many of the concerns raised by the likes of Professor Dworkin are less salient today, much less salient, than they were before the Joint Committee on Human Rights came into existence.